Well, first of all, I want to express my real sincere appreciation for how many of you have come out, all of you coming out on such a terrible, terrible day. I mean, I'm really quite impressed and pleased that so many of you did decide to
just
come.
Just another spring day.
So thank you very much for being here. And I think it must certainly signify a very intense interest in this subject that you are here today, which also I appreciate very much. What I want to try to do in 30 minutes or so is to lay out what I think are the most crucial points in this book. I'm not going to be able to cover everything. I'm not going to be able to talk, for example, about the... I'm not even going to mention that Bibi Netanyahu has been trying to fool the rest of the world for years by saying that, well, we may have to attack Iran if the problem's not taken care of. That there's been a phony war crisis around the idea of Israeli threats to attack Iran for years. I have a chapter on that, which I think will be quite entertaining for folks who have lived through that period and have watched the way the news media has covered it. But I'm not going to talk about that. What I am going to talk about is the nature of what I call the manufactured crisis, which is a false narrative that has been created, particularly beginning with the Bush administration, about the Iranian nuclear program. Suggesting that it is merely a cover for a covert nuclear weapons program. And the nature of this false narrative is that it really began with the neoconservatives in the Bush administration, who we know, with very good documentation, had the intention of doing in Iran roughly what they did in Iraq. There was a strategy which was initially put forward in September 2001 after the 9/11 attacks, initiated by Douglas Feith at the Pentagon for Donald Rumsfeld, a memorandum for Donald Rumsfeld, which made not just the argument but presented a strategy for the Bush administration to carry out, which was that five countries in the Middle East, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Somalia, would be accused of supporting terrorism and would be the objects of a policy of regime change. That is to say, the objective would be regime change in all those countries, U.S. military force being a key ingredient in that strategy of regime change. And in the case, of course, of Iraq, we know that the Bush administration, with this neoconservative inner core really doing the hard work to prepare the ground, created a false intelligence case for war based on alleged WMD programs in Iraq. I make the case in this book that the neoconservatives intended, and in fact did, try to carry out the same kind of strategy of creating a rationale for war against Iran on the basis of an alleged WMD program, in this case nuclear weapons, and that strategy was led by John Bolton as Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, who worked closely with Israel, took unauthorized trips to Israel in 2003 and 2004, during which he met with Meir Dagan, the head of Mossad, and those meetings were unauthorized meetings, which the substance of which was never reported through normal State Department reporting cables. The first trip was June 2003, and it was followed within weeks by, we now know, Mossad creating a new office, which the purpose of which was to influence the news media coverage of Iran's nuclear program, including the turning over of documents which they claimed came from within Iran and, you know, their spies had picked up. This information, as I point out, is documented in a book, The Nuclear Jihadist, by Douglas France and Catherine Collins, which the information they got from Israeli sources, from multiple Israeli sources. Second trip by Bolton was in April of 2004, and 3 months later, we now know that a mysterious collection of documents surfaced and came into the hands of Western intelligence. And in November of 2004, the first public mention of this by the Bush administration was Colin Powell's remarks to reporters, November 17th, I believe it was the date, 2004, in which he said, "We have information now indicating that Iran is working very hard," quote unquote, "to combine their missile with," quote, "a weapon," unquote. A few days after that, Carsten Voigt, a Foreign Office, German Foreign Office official, gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal, it was published in the Wall Street Journal, that he said the United States and Europe should not make policy on Iran on the basis of single source headlines, and that this information that Colin Powell had commented on came from, quote, an Iranian dissident group. Now, that was a very mysterious set of circumstances, which no one in the news media saw fit to scratch their head and say, what's this all about? Let's find out. Let's talk to Carsten Voigt. Let's talk to the Germans. Let's talk to the intelligence community. Let's see what this is all about. There was not a single story about this. No follow-up stories. There are a lot of follow-up stories about the documents themselves about which Colin Powell and Carsten Voigt had commented, but nothing about the relationship between those two things. 3 years later, in 2007, I had a chance to talk with a second German source close to the German foreign minister who was visiting Washington, D.C., and I asked him, what's this about? You know, what's this apparent warning from Carsten Voigt about? He said, "I can assure you," this is a direct quote, "I can assure you that those documents came from the Iranian Armed Resistance Organization." That meant the Mujahideen-e Khalq. That was an eye-opener. That really opened my eyes, and that's why I wrote this book, because after that, I realized that there was a story here that was not being covered. And I began to ask questions and began to look, particularly after 2008, when the IAEA was publishing reports which detailed or described these mysterious documents, which they had been told, according to Mohammed El-Baradei in his memoirs, the IAEA had been told that these documents came from somebody who had been in the covert Iranian nuclear weapons program. And by the way, the Americans told the IAEA officials, "We're not sure if the person who actually originally provided these documents is still alive." So, you know, that's why we can't really say anything more about this. So I began to look at carefully at what was said about these documents, how they were described, what was the content of the documents. Two documents in particular were very important in this regard. The first one, of course, was the one that Colin Powell was describing in his public remarks in November 2004. They were computer modeling efforts to integrate what looked like a nuclear weapon, although it was not explicit, into the Shahab, into the reentry vehicle, the nose cone of the Shahab 3 missile. And there were apparently as many as 18 different computer modeling efforts documented. The second one was that I want to talk about in particular, to zero in on, was a one-page design for a bench-scale uranium conversion facility, process for a uranium conversion facility. Now, bear in mind that the Iranians already had a uranium conversion facility, which they'd studied, tested, done research on, tested for like 10 years. And then they'd actually built. They'd actually committed themselves to building a conversion facility already. But nevertheless, in these documents, you have this plan for what appeared to be a secret conversion facility that the military supposedly was sponsoring. So what I did was to look at, create a timeline, essentially, of the Iranian nuclear program and the Iranian missile program. And without, I won't go into detail here, but I'll just tell you that I have in detail documented the critical anomalies, the contradictions between what is said by the IAEA in their reports about what these documents, either in the reports or in Ali Hainunen, the then director of Safeguards Department for the IAEA, in his briefing presentation to member states in February 2008. I relied on those two sources to do this. But the contradiction between what was said in those reports and briefings and independently verifiable dates of what was going on in the Iranian missile program and in its nuclear program. And I was able to establish that it's simply not possible what was being said by the IAEA about these, the contents of these documents, that this could be an, that these could be authentic documents, because the just to state it in the briefest way possible, the description of the computer modeling of the reentry vehicle showed the wrong reentry vehicle. It showed a reentry vehicle that was the original Shahab 3, which clearly the outside world, including Mossad, still believed was the missile that the Iranian defense ministry and military was developing when they said these, you know, when these documents were being created in 2002 and 2003. It was only in 2004 that the Iranians flight tested this follow-on improved model of an intermediate range missile, with a, which they eventually called Ghadr 1. So that's when the outside world, including again Mossad, would have been aware that there was this entirely new missile whose the nose cone of which did not resemble the original nose cone of the Shahab 3 at all. And so that was a giveaway. And the second giveaway was that the Iranian firm that the documents claim did the bench scale model for a uranium conversion process was also alleged to have been in charge of another sub-project of what was called Project 5, which was for ore management or uranium conversion and uranium enrichment. And that project was given the code name 5.15. Well, it turns out, yes, there was a Project 5.15, and it was indeed this company that was in charge of that project. It was for ore management. But it was not the defense ministry or some outcropping of the defense ministry or the Iranian military that was doing that project. It was the civilian Iranian Atomic Energy Organization. And the real problem is that the contract for that project was signed almost 2 years before the beginning of this purported covert nuclear weapons project had begun in 2001. So there's a problem in regard to these documents of contradictions that really give away the fact that they are not authentic. Now, where did the documents really come from? Well, the story that is now revealed in this is that indeed it was the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the MEK, the terrorist organization that had killed American civilians and military people in Iran during the Shah's regime, then when the Shah was overthrown and the new Islamic government was set up and they came to into conflict with the new government, they blew up government-sponsored meetings and killed many civilians and injured many civilians in the bombings. And then, of course, during the Iran-Iraq War, they became an asset of the Iraqi Saddam Hussein regime, used to carry out operations against Iran. In the 1990s, finally, they made their arrangements primarily with Mossad. They had an understanding with the Israeli government. They worked very closely with the Israelis, so they were indeed an Israeli government asset by the time these documents surfaced. And so the story that I reveal in here is that the German intelligence agency, the BND, when Colin Powell made his public remarks, called in this foreign office official, Carsten Voigt, for a talk and told him that they knew all about these documents. They knew about the information that Colin Powell had talked about publicly because they'd gotten it from one of their sources. They'd gotten those documents from one of the sources that they had been using in the past. And it was indeed a member of the Mujahideen Khalq who gave them the documents. And furthermore, the senior officials of the BND told Carsten Voigt that they regarded the source as doubtful. They didn't trust the source. And therefore, they were doubtful about relying on these documents. And they were not happy that Colin Powell had made these public remarks. And, of course, there's a context here. There's a historical context, which Carsten Voigt pointed out to me, referred to the fact that we had another case on Iraq, which, of course, goes by the name of Curveball, because the source who had told the tales of mobile bioweapons labs in Iraq, which became the centerpiece of Colin Powell's presentation to the United Nations Security Council in February 2003, was the Iraqi source called Curveball, which the BND, I mean, he wasn't a spy for the BND. He was simply somebody who was a refugee in Germany who told these tales to BND officers, and they went back and talked to him over and over again, and they passed on the stories to the CIA, to their fellow CIA officials. But after a few times of hearing this guy talk, they realized that he wasn't really reliable. He wasn't credible. And so that's the parallelism here. You have a second time that a BND source, not a BND spy, but a BND source, who the BND had figured out was not credible, provided strategic intelligence which the Bush administration decided to use publicly to cite as the basis for charging that, first of all, Iraq and then Iran were involved with a nuclear weapons program. And the final parallelism is that in the case of Iraq, the head of the BND, August Hanning, was asked by George Tenet of the CIA in December 2002, is it okay if we make public this information from the BND? And Hanning wrote back a handwritten personal two-page note to George Tenet saying, not really. Basically, according to Hanning himself, the message said, we think that this is not material that the United States should rely upon without confirmation. This is unconfirmed information. You should not rely on it without confirmation. And, of course, we know that that advice was disregarded by George Tenet. And in the case of Iran, we know that the Foreign Office official, Carsten Voigt, publicly did, in fact, issue that warning, a coded warning, but nevertheless a clear warning to those in the CIA who, if they were not warned by the BND directly, they certainly would have seen what he was getting at in his Wall Street Journal interview. And even if they didn't get it, certainly it would have been incumbent on high officials of the CIA to have the station chief in Berlin call up his colleague at BND and say, what's this all about? And, you know, find out, in fact, what he meant. So either way, we know that the CIA chose to ignore the warning from the BND through Karsten Voigt, if not through directly from the BND to the CIA for a second time. And so that parallelism, I call it in the book an Iranian curveball, is really at the center of what I refer to as the manufactured crisis, because after that, of course, the Bush administration pursued this strategy of using what the IAEA chose to call the alleged studies when Mohammed El-Baradei was still the director general. That was a term which suggested a little distance, if not a lot of distance, between the IAEA and these documents. Later on, however, after El-Baradei left, they were called possible military dimensions, which, of course, is a much more politically leading term to use. And so the Bush administration pushed these documents on the IAEA, wanted the IAEA to confront the Iranians with them as part of a broader strategy for laying the groundwork for what they ultimately hoped would be regime change in Iran, which would require some degree of U.S. use of military force. As Bolton suggests in his own memoirs, and which David Wormser, who was one of the key figures in this neoconservative plan, also has said publicly, that the presumption was that, you know, they would not have to do what they did in Iraq, but yes, they would have to use military force. And if military force was used in Iraq, it would have to be going all the way in terms of bombing, that they should kill the bear, not just wound the bear. So that was the plan that they had in mind. So from 2004 on, you have this plan going into action with the Bush administration using the IAEA as a forum for basically accusing Iran of having a covert nuclear weapons program. And the IAEA carried out a far-reaching investigation from 2004 through 2007 of six different issues. And I have a chapter which goes into detail about what happened in this investigation, or these investigations. The idea was that in each case, I'm not going to go into detail because it would take too long, in each case, these were incidents or behaviors that suggested to the Safeguards Department of the IAEA that the Iranians were doing something that indicated that they were pursuing nuclear weapons. In each case, however, it turned out that there was a perfectly innocent explanation, because the Iranians, at the end of this four-year investigation, under a work program that was negotiated between Mohammed El-Baradei and the Iranians provided full details on all documentation on all these issues, and in every case, the IAEA had to acknowledge that they had no information that contradicted it, nor any information that could in any way challenge the explanation the Iranians were giving for these behaviors. Sometimes nuclear experiments, in other cases, it was a document that they'd gotten from the AQ Khan group, which news media coverage suggested it was a plan for a nuclear weapon. It was how to build a nuclear weapon. Well, it wasn't that at all. It was nothing of the sort. And even Ali Heinonen admitted that in his briefing for member states. I think it was 2005 or 2006. But in any case, the Iranians cleared this up completely. They were able to refute every one of the accusations that were implicitly being made by the IAEA in investigating these things. But then, of course, the attention of the IAEA turned fully to the alleged studies documents. And it was at that point that Ali Heinonen, as I document in the book, came up with a strategy aimed at showing that the Iranians were unwilling to cooperate with their investigation of these documents. A very clever strategy, based on making the case that the Iranians had admitted that some of the information in the documents was authentic and accurate. Well, that was a less than half truth, because what the Iranians did admit to was that there were individuals who were real, there were places that were real, and there were organizations that were real in the documents. And as they said, look, anybody who's going to fabricate documents is obviously going to put in real people and places and organizations to make it look real. And so I must say that I began to realize from my research that Ali Heinen was really not playing straight, frankly. And by the way, I interviewed Ali Heinen, and I talk about my interview with Ali Heinen in this book, two interviews, one in person here in Cambridge and one by phone, in which he was unable to explain the contradictions that I brought up in the documents. So I want to simply state that there was a second round of documents from 2008 through 2009 provided by Israel to the IAEA. And the reason they were provided was that there was a 2007 NIE that had said, yeah, Iran had a nuclear weapons program 2001 to 2003, but they stopped it. And that was bad news to the Israelis because they needed to have a narrative that said Iran was still working on nuclear weapons. So they came out with a whole new set of documents, a whole new string of documents, and intelligence reports that suggested in some cases that Iran was still working on nuclear weapons after 2003. And I show how these documents clearly do not pass the laugh test for a variety of reasons. And, you know, if you want to know more, we can talk about that in the question and answer session. Now, just to conclude, I think the reason that that this strategy has been so successful, that the documents that we're talking about here have achieved an extremely high degree of credibility for two reasons. One, the IAEA took them on and treated them as credible, quote unquote. They never said they were authentic, but they said they were credible. And that distinction was, of course, lost on the news media, and the news media basically continued to cover that story. And the second reason, I think even more important today, is the 2007 NIE. And that NIE, as I said, of course, concluded that Iran did indeed have a nuclear weapons program from 2001 to 2003, but they had halted it in 2003. In this book, I have an entire chapter on intelligence failure, and that chapter is really history of the national intelligence estimates and how they were completely the product of an intelligence community that was leaning very hard in one direction. It was not an objective intelligence community, but particularly the CIA's Center on Proliferation, which was created in 1991, was leaning very hard towards the assumption that Iran wanted to get nuclear weapons and indeed was headed towards a nuclear weapons program. And in 2001, for the first time, the intelligence community concluded that Iran did have a nuclear weapons program. Paul Pillar, who was the national intelligence officer for the Middle East and participated in that 2001 estimate, has said that there was no hard evidence, there was no evidence, there was only inference that on which that was based. It was based totally on inference. And in 2005, again, Paul Pillar was still the NIO, and again, he said the 2005 NIE, which concluded, again, that Iran had a nuclear weapons program. Again, mind you, this is 2005. This is 2 years after, supposedly, the Iranians halted their nuclear weapons program. The NIE of 2005 concludes they now have a nuclear weapons program. And again, Pillar says there was no evidence. There's no evidence of weaponization. There was only inference. In 2007, I was able to find out from Thomas Finger, from a long interview that I had with him last year, that in June of 2007, the team doing the estimate did a first draft. And they concluded, guess what? The Iranians have a nuclear weapons program. 2007. June 2007, the Iranians still have a nuclear weapons program. And the evidence? Apparently it was the documents that we're talking about in this book. Nothing more. It was those documents. That's all they had. And Finger told me, yes, we believe those documents were authentic. We believe that they clarified the nuclear intentions of Iran. So I'm prepared, and I make this case in the book, I'm prepared to say that one cannot rely on the conclusion of the November 2007 NIE that Iran did have a nuclear weapons program in 2001 to 2003, because as Thomas Finger said to me, the intelligence community was very, very strongly committed to the idea that previous estimates were like holy writ, holy texts that should not be disowned. And they continued to refer to their earlier judgments on this subject. So it's clear that they were not being objective in 2007, as they were not objective in 2005 and 2001. And the final thing I want to say, and I know I'm taking more time than I should have, but I want to make this final point. This issue of the authenticity of the documents and the falsehoods surrounding the nuclear narrative about Iran is not just a matter of historical interest. As somebody once said, you may be through with history, but history ain't through with you. And in this case, this history is now very much a direct part, has a direct part in the nuclear negotiations with Iran. Because the Obama administration is taking the position that Iran must satisfy the IAEA, which has gone on record, of course, over the years, over and over again, saying that we have all this evidence that Iran has been working on nuclear weapons, must satisfy the IAEA on the possible military dimensions. Now, I'm quite convinced that they were under pressure to do this from the Israelis, and that that's why they did it. But this creates a serious problem for these talks, because there's only two possibilities. Either Yukiya Amano, the present head of the IAEA, is going to admit that they have not been telling the truth all this time and that these documents are false, or the Iranians are going to have to confess that they've been lying and that these documents are authentic. And I can tell you that the latter is not going to happen. And that leaves only one way out of this. And I don't think that's very likely either. I don't think either of those two possibilities are very likely. And that means the talks are going to break down. And that's where I want to leave it.
What I'm hearing in this, guilty until proven innocent.
Right.
That was enforced on Iraq.
That was exactly the case, yes.
It's enforced on Syria.
Right. And for the people, the hardliners in the intelligence community, they kind of forgot the until proven innocent part of it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, just guilty.
Yeah, right. Probably guilty, so let's just call it.